Good evening, everyone, and welcome to what is in some ways a bonus share from our three-part series that we were learning very, very recently. What does it mean to yearn for Mashiach? You don't actually have to have listened to or attended those shiurim to appreciate what we're going to be talking about. However, this shear, to a certain extent, is very much built upon the foundation of those shiurim. And this is where I would say the slight bad news is that it's impossible to do this topic as a standalone shear, but to a certain extent, all the exciting stuff, therefore, has already been talked about. Like this is, I'd like to think, a very interesting topic, but the actual, I would say, quote unquote, controversial content was really discussed in the series itself when we understood modern Orthodox skepticism towards messianism. So if you've not had a chance to listen to especially the final part in that three-part series, I would encourage doing so, to perhaps round out maybe a few other questions that might otherwise arise. But just to kind of put it in a nutshell, the most important thing to accept, and again, in that previous year, we discussed it at length, so now we're just going to take it as a given. In the modern Orthodox world, while we believe in Mashiach coming, Ki lishuatcha kivinu kol hayom, we say in our davening that we yearn for God's redemption, there is a general and very strong hesitance, for one reason or another, to resist any messianic speculation, any confident claim that Mashiach is here, any desire to a certain extent to hasten his arrival beyond the boundaries of davening. And what I mean by that is, in the modern Orthodox world, we don't subscribe to the belief that by performing mitzvot you are somehow bringing Mashiach closer, or at least that that is a motivating factor for mitzvot. You want to give tzedakah, you should give tzedakah because charity is good. And that is, in and of itself, its reward. We're not focused on corollaries like, well, giving charity also, say, brings us closer to Mashiach. That's just not per se on the ideological agenda. So this causes a tremendous tension in the modern Orthodox world, because we make tremendous contact with the religious Zionist world, which, as we'd already previously talked about, but we'll see as I share the source sheet once again, a fundamental belief of the religious Zionist world is that in some sense or another, the state of Israel is the instantiation of Mashiach. And so this is taken from, this is an English, this is a translation of Rav Aviner, source number one. So Rav Aviner is a very, very, very prominent rabbi in the religious Zionist world. He's the Rosh Yeshiva of Ateret Kohanim. Ateret Kohanim, for those of you who are unaware, is located in the Muslim quarter of the Old City. It is very much like one of the most intensely ideological yeshivot in Israel. Ateret Kohanim is an organization. They're very active in America. Friends of Ateret Kohanim are basically trying to buy as much of the Muslim quarter as possible to make Jewish. Ateret Kohanim is an interesting place because it is, I've been there. It's a very, very, very small footprint. And so a lot of their rooms pull multiple duty, and it's very kind of cobbled together. It's a very interesting place to visit. Not that you're necessarily putting it on the trip of thing on the things to visit your next trip to Israel, but Rav Aviner is a very, very prominent and interesting, for many reasons, figure in the religious Zionist world. But in the 1980s, he wrote the following. The Messianic process, source number one, the Messianic process is a concrete divine reality. The action upon history of a powerful redeemer, the Rock of Israel, who lives within history. If someone whispers in your ear that he has not seen the Messiah lately, either in the fields of the Golan or in the expanse of the Sinai, he may be an honest man. But if he goes a step further and says, "Since I have not seen it, it does not exist," his words are ones of falsehood and seduction. Say to him, "You may not have seen it, but others have. We declare the absolute certainty of our imminent redemption. All the troubles, delays, and complications we have endured are merely momentary. and cannot obscure this mighty overall trend, this messiah, whose power has been concealed since ancient times in the treasure house of history, and who is now being revealed in actuality. That is religious Zionism, Rav Kook, religious Zionism 101, right? The state of Israel is Mashiach, in some sense. We're not going to fixate on the details today. That's not our concern, but either the state of Israel is in some sense the messianic process itself, or an indication that Mashiach is nigh. Regardless, that is the fundamental belief of it's a motivating belief of the religious Zionist world, which brings us to the prayer for the state of Israel. We actually in BIV say a little bit of a cobbled together prayer, but it still includes the crucial phrase for us. But the prayer begins, Avinu Shebashamayim, our Father in heaven, so Yisrael, Ga'ala, Rock and Redeemer of Israel. You'll notice these are words borrowed. Rav Aviner is borrowing in his thing in source one. Barech et Medinat Yisrael, bless the state of Israel. Reshit Smichat Geulatenu, the first flowering of our redemption. It seems pretty clear that this is an explicit reference to this religious Zionist messianic vision, that the state of Israel is Geula. It's the beginning of Geula. It's the beginning of redemption. There you go. We refer to the state of Israel within this prayer with such language. There are, it should be noted, certain versions of the prayer for the state of Israel, like the one I think is common mostly in England, though in Bnei Akiva we always added in Reshit Smichat Geulatenu as a point. But there are, I would say, non-messianic versions of the prayer for the state of Israel, but the most popular one, the one that's from Israel itself, includes this phrase. Honestly, there are a lot of questions we could ask about the prayer for the state of Israel, because there are other issues we might point to express our issues with the prayer. You know, Rav Soloveitchik most famously didn't like the prayer in any way, not for any other ideological reason than he didn't think modern humans have the ability to compose new prayers. Rav Amital, someone we'll be talking a little bit more about, but Rav Amital, the founding Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshivat Har Etzion and a prominent rabbi in the religious Zionist world, and he is apparently quoted as often saying, you know, Jews don't begin their prayers with "Our Father who art in heaven, blessed be thy name." So, you know, the construct of the prayer, maybe we could take issue with. Definitely, right, there is a tremendously significant question to be asked about why on earth do we stand for it? And that's not really something Jews do, if you've ever thought about it. Like, we stand for very specific moments of tefillah. But the idea of standing almost as a mark of respect for the prayer for the state of Israel, that's not a Jewish thing. The fact that it's also announced beforehand, right? There's lots of other questions we could ask about the entirety of the prayer for the state of Israel. But the main question, our question for tonight, given already established in the third part of our three-part series on what does it mean to yearn for Mashiach, that there is a genuine aversion within the modern Orthodox world to messianic statements. How on earth can we be comfortable in the modern Orthodox world getting up and saying or hearing the fact that Israel is Reshit Smichat Geulatenu? It seems to fly in the face of everything we otherwise believe. So one simple answer that we have to acknowledge is that people don't really care or notice. How many people actually, first of all, are bothered by messianism enough to therefore subscribe to modern Orthodox understandings of messianism and then be bothered by Reshit Smichat Geulatenu? You could count them on one hand in a shul of 1,000 people. The other reason, which is maybe a little bit more of a disturbing reason, is people think this is a litmus test of their Zionism. That we refer to Israel as Reshit Smichat Geulatenu because we want to be among the people who refer to Israel as Reshit Smichat Geulatenu, and we will forfeit our ideological, our theological beliefs in favor of, you know, declaring the purity of our Zionism. But putting those two answers aside, why, what, what permits us to say this? How on earth can we say this when we're so uncomfortable otherwise with messianism? And you will remember from the third part in the three-part series how Rav Lichtenstein was a significant figure within the modern Orthodox world who's very, very against messianic declarations. And there is an amazing story about Rav Lichtenstein that is recorded in Eliashiv Reichner's biography of Rav Amital. So Rav Amital, founding Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshivat Har Etzion, then brings over Rav Lichtenstein to be his co-Rosh Yeshiva. Rav Lichtenstein from America, from YU, son-in-law of Rav Soloveitchik, the ultimate expression of modern Orthodox Jew. Rav Amital from the world of Rav Kook, the ultimate expression of religious Zionist Jew. And so in the book, Eliashiv Reichner recounts various, like, it's a very positive book. Like, even though Rav Amital and Rav Lichtenstein were sometimes ideologically at tension, they nonetheless didn't actually fight each other and instead worked with one another for the good of the yeshiva. So anyway, he recounts this story. Source number three, during the early years of Yeshivat Har Etzion, Rav Amital often spoke about the establishment of the State of Israel in terms of the messianic redemption. Rav Lichtenstein, as a disciple of Rav Soloveitchik, was skeptical of characterizing the state as the beginning of redemption. Addressing the messianic atmosphere that prevailed after the Six-Day War, he frequently told students, in a somewhat cynical tone, that he had not seen Mashiach roaming the streets of Yerushalayim. The students had difficulty accepting his position. Some of them even engaged in heated debates with him on the issue. And the story actually goes on to talk about how, like, Rav Amital was like, I respect Rav Lichtenstein's position, even though I disagree with it. But the point is, and if you remember with source one, Rav Aviner's frustration with people who walk around saying they've not seen Mashiach. So this was kind of Rav Lichtenstein's quip. I'm commuting in from Yerushalayim every day. I've yet to see Mashiach walking around the streets, right? He's not here. This is Rav Lichtenstein, ultimate exemplar of modern orthodoxy against a religious Zionist environment, and he is very resistant to the messianism and very uncomfortable with Reshit Tzmichat Geulatenu. In YU, they don't say Reshit, or they historically did not say Reshit Tzmichat Geulatenu because of, again, Soloveitchikian discomfort with the phrase. We have to answer three questions in order to better understand how to process the tension. The first question, which is worth exploring, is whether or not Reshit Tzmichat Geulatenu is messianic, right? I've just taken it as a given that the first flowering of redemption is messianic, but it's worth kind of, it's worth confirming that fact, because some people might suggest it's poetry as opposed to explicit messianic doctrine. Another question which is kind of related, and this is how you know I'm not really a literature guy, is because I care about authorial intent. But basically, what is the authorial intent of the prayer for the State of Israel? Does Reshit Tzmichat Geulatenu sniff and smell of messianism is question number one. Question number two is, was it put in the prayer for the State of Israel in order to explicitly indicate messianic belief? And number three is, does it really matter? What is lost by saying Israel is Reshit Tzmichat Geulatenu? So to turn to the first question, which is what is the phrase referring to? What is it talking about? When I confidently declare it's messianic, how do I know that? Is it true, or is it maybe just poetry? So this expression does not come from nowhere. The term in some sense might already be used within Chazal, obviously not to refer to the State of Israel, but it definitely, these kinds of terms really begin to find expression with the rabbis who we might retroactively refer to as the first religious Zionists. So already in the 17th century, Jews were moving to live in the land of Israel. There's a very, very popular myth. This is a side point, but as a Davkinik, I have to mention this. There's a very, very popular myth that the students of the Vilna Gaon were the first people to kind of move to Israel. And it's a really, really popular myth because it kind of implies that the first Jews to go live in the land of Israel were religious Jews, and therefore religious Zionists are descendants of that first wave of people. It's not true. Right? It's obviously much more complicated than that, but like it's actually a myth. But people nonetheless were living in the land of Israel. Jews, religious Jews, were living in the land of Israel already before, long before Herzl. And that did already get rabbis to start thinking about the not only the halachic ramifications of Jews living in Israel, but the theological ramifications of having a presence of religious Jews in Israel. And the first rabbis to write about such things, rabbis Zvi Hirsch Kalischer, who lived in Poland. He died in 1874. For context, Herzl is born in 1860. So, you know, Zvi Hirsch Kalischer was born 100 years before Herzl, basically. And also Rabbi Yehuda Al-Kalai, who lived around the same time in the Ottoman Empire. So if you look at source number four, and it's from Zvi Hirsch Kalischer writing in Drishat Zion, again, he's writing long before Herzl is even bar mitzvahed. Probably didn't have a bar mitzvah, but anyway. Geulat Yisrael she'anachnu chokim la. The redemption of Israel that we yearn for. Al yachshov ha'choshev ki pit'om yered Hashem yitbarach shemo mishamayim va'aretz. Don't think that suddenly, boom, God will cause it to descend from heaven instantly. Le'mor la'amotze'u, you know, telling his people, go out. Or that he's just going to send Mashiach, and we're going to hear, you know, to sound the great shofar to redeem us all. Ki im ma'at ma'at tavog ulat Yisrael. For only step by step will the redemption of the Jewish people come. La'at la'at, little by little, also an Oasis song, little by little, tatzmiach keren Yeshua, will the exaltation of his power flourish. So one, Rav Yehuda Al-Kalai says similar things. He uses the term kim'ah, kim'ah. The very, very first thinkers, and this makes sense historically because very few Jews were living in Israel. The very first thinkers to address the topic were very, very, very hedgy. This makes sense based on when you think about what we talked about in the three-part series with the general hesitancy of rabbis to make declarative statements about Mashiach, or to put that slightly differently, the hesitancy of a large group of rabbis to make declarative statements about Mashiach. The half that were happy making declarative statements about Mashiach, that's a whole other discussion. But we already start to see reference to Israel, the possibility of redemption through the Jewish people living in the land of Israel, but in very, very guarded terms. In sources 5 and 6, we have two other figures. One is far better known than the other in the religious Zionist world. But the first is Rabbi Yehoshua Yaakov Trunk of Kotno, who was a very, very prominent Polish rabbi. He lived in the 1800s, and he's asked about essentially whether there's a mitzvah to move to the land of Israel. It's somewhat plausible in his day. Should one do so? And he writes, "V'ein safik shehi mitzvah gedola." There's no doubt that moving to the land of Israel is a great mitzvah. Ki hakibutz hu, for this in gathering, it's atchalta de geula. It is the beginning of the redemption. Rav Kook, similarly, "V'ein safik." There's no doubt that this great movement, Zionism, he atchalted the geula, that is the beginning of the redemption, shetavo b'mhera v'yameinu amen, may it come very soon. V'anu chayavim lehitchozek ba'od imanu v'orad arei elokeinu b'chol ha'ometa efshari. Admittedly, Rav Kook is hard to understand, and my Hebrew isn't the greatest, so my translation skills aren't perfect with this line, but basically we have to help. Right, we have to help the people, right? It's a good thing. It's the Atchalta de Geula. These are both contemporaries of Herzl. Zionism now exists as a thing. And the phrase that they are using is far more explicitly messianic. We saw ma'at ma'at la'at la'at kima kima. Slow, slow, step by step, bit by bit, very hedgy. By the time Zionism is in full flow, we've moved to the Atchalta de Geula. Rav Issa Zalman Meltzer, who was one of the most prominent rabbis living in Israel pre Declaration of the State of Israel, he also used the term to describe the partition plan. The UN partition plan was, he declared, Atchalta de Geula. So this idea of Geula being in its early stages, very much present among the early religious Zionist thinkers. As a fun fact, so when last year we were clearing out the upstairs area of the gym at BIAV, now remember, BIAV is an amalgamation of like four different shuls. So there were, I don't know whatever happened to them, there were a bunch of framed pictures that were in when that that room had served as a classroom at some point. And they were from the eye of BIAV, Tiferes Yisrael. But it was pictures of a lot of these major proto-Zionist thinkers. So clearly, at some point, there was this huge religious Zionist, if not school, then effort within the community. Maybe they were free posters sent by an organization. But it was your Rav Cooks, and it was your Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalishers and all these others. Like, it was kind of like a good, like, I should have kept them as a good litmus test of religious Zionism. Like, you know, name these faces. If you can't, get a book. But all of this is, I just remembered that because of Issa Zalman Meltzer. You might not even be in one of the pictures, but I just remember it being like a bunch of these guys. And like on the surface, they just look like standard Eastern European rabbis. But I'm like, there was a pattern. These are all the proto-religious Zionists. Anyway, most notably, in the run-up to the founding of the state, in 1947, Rav Herzog, who would go on to be, he was chief rabbi at the time, and he would go on to be the first Ashkenazi chief rabbi of the State of Israel, wrote far more guarded here. Uvaruch, so he's writing in a letter to someone, Uvaruch hu shegianu l'shalev zeh, you know, thanking God that we've reached this stage, we're on the cusp of the State of Israel being declared. Af al pisha adayan, eino ela adchalta de geula. Even though, you know, this stage it's only the beginning of the redemption. Ve'ulai rak adchalta de adchalta, or maybe only the beginning of the beginning. So Rav Herzog, the first chief rabbi of the State of Israel, actually the chief rabbi of the State of Israel, was embracing the language of messianism and redemption, while at the same time being a little bit hedgy. There is a fun suggestion by Rabbi Dr. Jacob J. Schachter, who points out that, there's a famous Churchill speech. So Herzog, for a while, was the chief rabbi in Ireland. Definitely, it is plausible that he would be familiar with this famous Churchill speech, because it was on a British victory. I forget the details now. It was a British victory that ultimately ensured the survival of the Yeshuv in Israel, the Jewish population within Israel. Some sort of World War II Germans getting close to Israel and the British repelled them. You're welcome. But so Churchill made this famous speech where he, you know, he says, now is not the end. It's not even the beginning of the end, but it is perhaps the end of the beginning. So Rabbi Dr. Jacob J. Schachter, you know, suggests that maybe this is kind of a turn of phrase that Rabbi Herzog is trying to kind of like use here with like atchalta de atchalta. Like that was an in vogue, Churchill made that like an in vogue kind of phrase you'd want to start aping. Anyway, what we've seen is admittedly no explicit reference to reshit semichat geulatenu, but nonetheless, geula is a big giveaway here, right? All the early religious Zionist thinkers were obsessed with the notion of Geula and the beginning of redemption. The Atchalta of the Geula, it's coming. It is obvious that Reshit Smichat Geulatenu, the beginning of the first flowering of our redemption, is a child of these ideas. It is obviously linked to the Atchalta de Geula. We'll have to ask in a second, why does the Prophet of the State of Israel not refer to the State of Israel as the Atchalta de Geula? But for now, it is obvious, it is undeniable, that at least its conceptual framework is a messianic one. It's not just a nice idea. It's obvious theological language about Mashiach. Things get more interesting when we ask who composed the prayer for the state of Israel. So one of the most boring topics you could possibly ever attempt to learn about, trust me on this one, or put it another way, if on a Friday night you want to go to sleep, don't read about this topic because, boy, you will fall asleep straight away and you'll have to read it all another time, is the controversy surrounding the creation of the prayer for the state of Israel. First of all, the prayer for the state of Israel underwent like an exit. People who don't have never noticed my desire to exaggerate, I'm just going to give you a warning now, lest what I say be repeated as fact. The prayer for the state of Israel underwent 15,000 changes between its original writing and becoming like the one we have today in the space of like a month. Originally, by the way, so one of the often counterpoints to the fact that the prayer for the state of Israel is not messianic is the fact that the end of the prayer for the state of Israel includes a prayer for Mashiach to come. That was not original. That was added later because people protested that it was too overtly messianic. You're not even davening for Mashiach to come. So now the classic prayer for the state of Israel does contain references praying for Mashiach, but it did not originally start that way. But there's a lot of versions of the prayer for the state of Israel in the early days of the state. They all orbit the same broad idea, but slightly different. Three different people were involved in the composition of the prayer. Number one, Rav Herzog, Ashkenazi chief rabbi of the state of Israel. Number two, Rabbi Ben Sion Uziel, the Sephardi chief rabbi of the state of Israel. And number three, Shai Agnon, who is the famous literary figure from Israel. You know, he won the Nobel Prize for Literature at some point. You know, basically a great poet and a religious poet. You know, I've never read any of his works because the way a friend of mine puts it is in English, there's no point. And in Hebrew, it's amazing, but it's hard to understand because he does. It's apparently beautiful. He'll like quote, be it Chazal, be it other things, is something Shai Agnon is very good for. So apparently the three of them together, and there is a major question. And again, the sort that will give you a good night's sleep on a couch. How exactly did the crafting get done? And it's one of those things that it's unclear exactly how. Shai Agnon, did he just add the polish or did he write it? And the chief rabbis then gave it a blessing, you know, gave it like their stamp of approval. For our purposes, there is one simple question. Who wrote the phrase, Reshit Smichat Geulateinu? So if we take a look at source number 8, Rav Herzog writes the following, and this is just English translations. By the way, there's some guy who wrote a PhD dissertation on this question, which again, must have had a lot of good nights of sleep. Rav Herzog writes the following, thank God we have merited that in the state of Israel, which is, as I referred to her in the text of the prayer that I established, the first flowering of our redemption, there is a flowering of the law of our holy Torah. So Rav Herzog, almost in passing, you know, this is going on at the same time as the State of the Union, which everyone else clearly is watching. But like, this is kind of classic, like State of the Union language. Like, just as a side point, by the way, that's my achievement, right? Everyone, like, we've done all of these things. I did that. You're welcome. I did that just before, by the way. So Rav Herzog says, I wrote Reshit Smichat Geulateinu. Thank you. You're welcome. Okay. Rav Herzog is the author of Reshit Smichat Geulateinu. Source number 9 is discussing Rav Ben Sion Uziel, and it writes the following, until he merited to see the establishment of the State of Israel, which he viewed as the first flowering of the redemption, an original phrase that he composed as part of the prayer that he wrote with the warmth of his heart and the fire of his love for Zion, that is the Tefillah Lishlom HaMedina. Okay, so according to source number 9, Rav Ben Sion Uziel composed the phrase Reshit Smichat Geulateinu, and not Rav Herzog. One of them is lying. Source number 10. A letter from Rav Herzog's secretary to Shai Agnon's daughter. To the best of my recollection, your father did not change much of Rav Herzog's text, but only shortened and improved the language here and there, kind of what you do for give a literary genius to do. And he added the phrase, Reshit Smichat Geulateinu, the first flowering of our redemption. apparently each of them was the contributor of the first flowering of the redemption. Now again, historians pore over these sources and others to try to identify which is the most plausible. But broadly speaking, Reshit Tzmichat Geulatenu could have been composed by any of them. And this complicates our assessment of the phrase Reshit Tzmichat Geulatenu. Because if it was Rav Herzog, we already know he was viewing the state of Israel in tremendous messianic terms, even if they were hedgy ones. It makes the phrase definitionally hyper-messianic. If it was Rav Ben Zion Uziel, well, he was also messianic skeptic. If it's Shai Agnon, however, this is where things get very interesting, because I mentioned Shai Agnon likes to borrow from rabbinic literature and turn it into poetry. If Shai Agnon referred to the state of Israel as Reshit Tzmichat Geulatenu, it somewhat neutralizes the messianic tone, because now it becomes a literary thing. It becomes like, oh, it's borrowed from it's poetry. It's borrowed from the language of messianic thinkers, but it's being used in a more, poetic way. It's a wink towards messianism. It's a beautiful artistic weaving of messianic ideas into the prayer for the state of Israel, but it is not as explicitly messianic, because by definition, Shai Agnon, by not being a rabbi, to a certain extent, he neutralizes any theological power to the prayer. And this is actually the problem, because then you can flip that exact idea. The problem is, if Shai Agnon composed Reshit Tzmichat Geulatenu, then as nice as it is, it's no longer a powerful declaration. It's just a nice poetic phrase written by a very, very observant, but nonetheless just literary figure. If one of the two chief rabbis composed it, it's a tefillah. It's a prayer composed by a rabbi, but with tremendous messianic overtones that we disagree with. And so it is hard exactly to parse. Either way, you are left questioning the value of referring to the state of Israel as Reshit Tzmichat Geulatenu, either because now it's just nice poetry, and if it could be construed as a messianic declaration, let's just get rid of it to avoid the misunderstanding, or alternatively, it's an overtly messianic declaration and we ideologically object to such ideas. Either way, Reshit Tzmichat Geulatenu is a complicated theological phrase. There is an additional dimension that I kind of want to close out with. And it's what is lost by saying, by referring to the state of Israel as Reshit Tzmichat Geulatenu, which is perhaps a politer way of asking what is lost by believing in the messianic power of the state of Israel. So the truth is, and I think I would have mentioned this in the third part of the three-part series, there are a lot of genuine political objections to viewing the state of Israel through a messianic lens. When you view the state of Israel as Mashiach, you have a very, very different political worldview than if you don't. But Rav Amital, who was one of the most powerful voices within the religious Zionist world, has a very, very powerful take. So this is, it's an article from Tradition, but it's basically his reflections after Gush Katif. So Israel gives up control of Gaza, thus bringing an end to a lot of the Yishuvim in that area, obviously. And that was a tremendously, I'm just going to scroll up so people don't get distracted by already starting to read it, but that was a tremendously theologically fraught moment for the religious Zionist world. Many religious Zionists lost their faith because, like, oh, Mashiach's going to come. He's not going to let us concede some of the land of Israel. And then it happened anyway. So Rav Amital is a prominent religious Zionist thinker. He's actually addressing the fact that some religious Zionists were calling to not celebrate Yom HaAtzmaut that year as kind of to protest the fact that, like, the government is clearly not something God wants because it doesn't fit our worldview. So Rav Amital writes the following. I can testify concerning myself that I recited the blessing of Shehecheyanu and I danced on November 29th, 1947 at Be'erot Yitzchak, even though the UN had partitioned the land, and likewise in 1948. Right? He was jubilant when the State of Israel was declared. Our feeling was one of elation. It was as though there was an intoxicating drug in the air, Israeli independence. We weren't rejoicing because of what Ramban taught. So he talks about earlier how like the motivation of like Ramban, that there's a mitzvah to conquer the entire land. In other words, we weren't celebrating the creation of the State of Israel because there is some sort of fulfillment of a partial fulfillment of a mitzvah. That's not what motivated Rav Amital. Rav Amital, by the way, this is just a fascinating, he was a Holocaust survivor. So he has a very, very, very harrowing, I forget now, it's been a while since I read a very, very harrowing description of like davening after being after being taken out of the camps. And he has a very, very powerful thing about faith and whatever, but I don't remember what that is, and that's not relevant to us, but I just remembered it right now. But rather because of the fulfillment of Herzl's vision, right? It was political Zionism that motivated his rejoicing that day. At that time, Rav Tzvi Yehuda recounted to Rav Kook's son, the leader of religious Zionism, his perspective on the declaration of the State of Israel, the father of religious Zionism. I could not go out and participate in the festivities, for indeed God's words, they have divided my land, was being fulfilled. In that condition, my whole body shaken, wounded all over, cut up into pieces, I could not rejoice. So Tzvi Yehuda Kook was unhappy when the State of Israel was declared, was unhappy at the UN partition plan because it was not the entire land. And so it was a painful day for him. Rav Amital continues, we, the simple Jews among whom I regarded myself, didn't know about Ramban. We knew that there was Israeli independence, Jewish sovereignty in our land, and we rejoiced over that. And then in the ellipses, I mean, he's talking for a while. It's like a transcript of his address, but he talks about the challenge, basically, of certain challenges, like demographic challenges, like if we annex the whole of Israel, all of a sudden the population gets diluted. And he talks about different approaches that people have suggested to solve this problem, but for our purposes is what he writes here. A second approach to the challenges facing the State of Israel, whose proponents included religious people with a zealous vision of greater Eretz Israel, claimed that the solution would be found with the coming of Mashiach. And since the Mashiach is already knocking at the door, there is no need to worry about the pragmatic actual ramifications of our actions. This messianic thinking, which perceived the Mashiach as already lurking somewhere in the Jerusalem mountains, soon to be revealed to us, is what led to this view. To my sorrow, I have not merited divine inspiration. I have never met a prophet who fit all of Rambam's identifying criteria, who told me that the Mashiach is already on the way. When I established Yeshivat Har Etzion, the architect who designed the Beit Midrash planned it without windows. I told her about the tzaddik in whose town a shofar blast was once heard, and the whole community thought the Mashiach had arrived. The tzaddik poked his nose out of the window, sniffed gently, and said, "No. When the Mashiach comes, it will be possible to sense it in the air. A Beit Midrash needs windows in order to be able to sense when the Mashiach is coming. If I haven't yet sensed the Mashiach's footsteps, it is a sign that the Mashiach hasn't yet come." Rav Amital's ended up becoming one of the more broad objectors to messianic religious Zionism. He was, as we saw in source number 3, he was one of the original expressors of messianic religious Zionism, and he came to deeply question it. One of the reasons is not so much political as political theological. That when you believe Mashiach is coming, you act differently, you act more extremely, you act with greater fundamentalism than if you don't believe Mashiach is coming. And that rubbed Rav Amital the wrong way. Additionally, apparently, famously, The Yom Kippur War really, really called him to question the messianic qualities of the state of Israel, because his yeshiva lost a lot of students in that war, as did many Hesder yeshivot. And he couldn't understand a world in which, if Mashiach is really coming, why are so many young boys dying? And so Rav Amital became very, very, very against viewing the state of Israel as the Atchalta de Geula, as Reshit Tzmichat Geulatenu. Even though he disagreed with the Rav Lichtenstein's modern Orthodox theological objections to the idea of messianism, Rav Amital objected to the practical ramifications of believing it. And this, I think, is actually a very important idea to internalize, because all too often we see Reshit Tzmichat Geulatenu as some sort of Zionistic litmus test, which can actually cause us to then imbibe, even without thinking, a very, very, very specific theological vision of the state of Israel. Not only does that completely run afoul of a theological framework that we otherwise broadly subscribe to, right? You know, in the modern Orthodox world, Rav Lichtenstein and Rav Soloveitchik are the bee's knees, right? You know, like, again, if you walked into Beis Medrash Gavoa in Lakewood, or you walked into 770 in Brooklyn, and you started talking about Rav Lichtenstein, people ain't interested. But in the modern Orthodox world, Rav Lichtenstein's view has tremendous weight. It's tremendous, you know, Rav Soloveitchik wrote modern Orthodox theology, effectively. A who's who of the modern Orthodox world were always opposed to messianic thinking writ large. But particularly when it came to the state of Israel, they grew even more cautious. But even within that world, the world that subscribed to the notion of Atchalta de Geula, other questions started to arise. If you believe that Israel is Mashiach, you think very differently. And so people like Rav Amital, whose Zionistic beliefs are beyond question, or his were beyond question, he's passed away, he nonetheless had an objection. And interestingly, he added one word to the prayer for the state of Israel. So he didn't omit Reshit Tzmichat Geulatenu. If you are a real Soloveitchikian, you omit Reshit Tzmichat Geulatenu. It is a bold rabbi. Rabbis in our shul, I might say, fortunately, I have a funny story for after the recording, and I really want to tell it, so I'm going to tell the story after the recording, because I need to have plausible deniability that I didn't actually share this story. For people who know me and are listening to this shit, I'm happy to tell you also after you are listening on YU Torah, feel free to text me or ask me what's the story. But if you don't know me and you just found this show on YU Torah, I'm sorry, this amazing, hilarious story that I don't want to be traced back to me. You will forever be wondering what it was. And that is why you have to attend Shiurim in person on Zoom. But rabbiglass@biv.org. Anyway, I got completely distracted. Oh, so bold rabbis, right? So I don't say the prayer. I don't say the prayer of Israel. Now, shul, Jeremy does fine. So in some shuls they will omit the phrase Reshit Tzmichat Geulatenu at all. In other shuls, they will adopt what Rav Amital suggested, which is Avinu Shebashamayim Tzur Israel V'Galah, our Father in Heaven, Rock and Redeemer of Israel, Baruch Et Medina Israel, bless the state of Israel, Shetehei Reshit Tzmichat Geulatenu, that it will be the first flowering of our redemption. Rav Amital turned it into a prayer for Geula. When we lived in New Jersey, and I was just a member of the shul, there was always a wonderful gentleman in the back, a very, very interesting figure, which obviously, because based on what I'm about to say, of course he was an interesting figure, who would always very audibly scream Shetehei out as the rabbi was reading the prayer for the state of Israel, because he very much, you know, believed in this. But that is the best known alternative that is, I would say, rubs people less the wrong way. Refusing to say Reshit Tzmichat Geulatenu upsets people because they think you're now being anti-Zionist. But if you say Shetahay, no one actually notices. And it, I mean, still, some people will object, but if they know what you're saying, they are more likely to recognize, oh, you're being all Rav Amital. And fine, a fun story that I will share on the recording. So Rav Soloveitchik famously, again, had a lot of issues with the Prayer of the Shev as well, but they did say the Prayer of the Shev as well in his shul, but they omitted the phrase Reshit Smichat Geulateinu. And this was also the case in YU until sometime in the recent future, I don't know when, where then they would refer to the state of Israel as Reshit Smichat Geulateinu. But it was originally, again, Rav Soloveitchik's insistence, that classic modern Orthodox theological belief that led to them omitting completely Reshit Smichat Geulateinu. But for one reason or another, be it theological, political, or strident theological rationales, there are strong reasons for questioning the phrase Reshit Smichat Geulateinu, especially when we subscribe to other more significant theological beliefs that seem to run afoul of that entire idea.